As far as I know, it would seem the only biography of her, which is in the book Eminent Victorians by Lytton Strachey. And it was written during the First World War, and it contained long essays about four eminent Victorians. Three of them were comprehensively demolished as pretentious and altogether unpleasant. Florence Nightingale, of course, got a much more favoured treatment. How objective it really was, I'm not quite sure, but it did emphasise very strongly her careful planning and also the very wide-ranging nature of her interests, both in the outskirts of what's now Istanbul, in the outskirts of Istanbul, both that, but also very wide-ranging interests and activity after she returned from the Crimea. It raises the question of the nature of the statistical work that she did. And I think one point is that her computational facilities were very limited in those days. Log tables, slide rules. I don't know how many people in the audience remember a slide rule. It was a piece of wood, and if used very carefully, you could show that 2 times 2 was something between 3.99 and 4.01. And if you had a very sophisticated slide rule, as I expect Florence Nightingale did, you might get another digit coming out. Otherwise, computationally, she would have been very limited. This accounts for the fact, I think, in part, that her her writing, the little of it that I've read, puts very strong emphasis on graphical methods of presentation, done in a very skillful and careful way. Models of clarity for the presentation of quite complicated pieces of data. In addition to her contacts from her confinement to her house, she was in touch with Quetelet in Belgium, who was the leading, perhaps the leading biostatistician of the 19th century. Quetelet, of course, the inventor of Quetelet's index, body mass over height squared, which is still a primary tool. She was in contact with Quetelet about various aspects of the more technical side of statistics. I think that that led on. Well, following the computational point, her computational facilities would have been very limited. As I said, she would have had French curves. I don't know how many people know what a French curve is, in the sense that I'm using it at any rate. Other senses one might think of it. But French curve is a shaped piece of wood which can be used in effect to fit spline functions, to fit cubic splines to empirical data. And it was still in, when I first started statistical work, which is more years ago than I want to think, but when I did, the use of a spline was expected, was one of the things one was expected to know. I was working in an engineering department, and splines were, spline fitting was used with these French curves to fit smooth curves to empirical functions. So that was one side, but the main development in the development of the more technical side of statistics hinges very, very strongly on developments in computation. And it wasn't until about 1870 or 1880, which is towards the end of Florence Nightingale's period of main activity, it wasn't till then that the hand Brunswicker calculator was invented and perfected in, I think, by collaboration between a Russian and a Swede. And the sound of the Brunswicker calculator, the grinding sound it made, echoed through the lecture halls of London and other universities, no doubt, in other working in many fields. The sound of the Brunswicker calculator was still to be heard as late as 1970 or so. I was going to say some more about computation. What it would do would be to add up a large number. It had no memory, but it would add up a very large number of numbers and their squares and their products. So you could form the sum of squares, sum of products, sum of squares of two variables, and the sum of products of them in one cumulative operation on the machine. But nevertheless, there was no storage. And so when one, for example, inverted a small matrix, I remember inverting a 7x7 matrix by the best available numerical methods available. This would have been about 1950 something. And it took 8 hours to invert a 7x7 matrix because every step had to be checked. Before I tried to do that calculation, I had quite dark brown hair. You can see now it's suddenly turned gray from the stress of doing that calculation. So computation has always driven what part of statistics is commonly and widely used. It's only very exceptionally that one can use, one in the past use methods that were not very feasibly computationally. So the history of the development of statistical theory and statistical methods is very, very much tied with the nature of computation, and in particular the nature of computation that is relatively painlessly available. Now, we've heard a great lecture. I hope it will be written up so that we can study it in detail. Thank you again, Deborah, for it.
Thanks, David. And I believe that David Spiegelhalter has also got a few comments that he'd like to make. So I'll just pass on to David Spiegelhalter.
Okay, I hope you can hear me all right. Yeah, you've got to excuse me being a bit nervous. I always am nervous speaking with David Cox around ever since he was my PhD examiner back in the 14th century sometime when I had dark hair as well. This was a fascinating lecture. There were all sorts of details about Florence that I didn't know about. Wonderful to see the window. And I really enjoyed it. But I'd like to focus on one particular aspect. And that's really tied up with the pandemic that we're in at the moment, where, as Deborah mentioned, the scientists and the statisticians have been working their watsits off. It's just working so hard. I mean, as a slight aside, I do hope that this is appreciated by people, just how hard, everyone has been working during this period. Either for the same salary or for no money at all. And the stress involved in it. So but I think in a way, I'm sure Florence Nightingale would have relished this opportunity to bring together a data and policy. And she'd have been right in the middle of it, I'm sure, because she, as I mentioned when I did this lecture last year, she was like a one-woman pressure group, collecting data, influencing all over the place. She knew everybody, all from her bed, writing letters, sending presents, and, you know, extraordinary energy and effort that she put in. But she was concerned with policies. She wanted to change things. She wanted to make things happen. And last year I said, would she use Twitter? But even now I really wonder about, would she have been content to be a statistician who tries to gather evidence, of course, and that can be used by policymakers, but would she have been actually advocating for specific policies? And I would love some people's opinion. I'd love David's opinion, Crystal's opinion, anyone's opinion on this, because I kind of think it is an important issue. It's something I've been wrestling with all throughout this whole pandemic. I've been, like other statisticians, like Jen and others, doing a lot of media work. And I've been trying all the time to steer this middle way. I don't feel happy to say this is what should be done. All I want to be able to do is to try to explain what the evidence is and, if necessary, appeal for better communication of the evidence and better evidence and to go out there and actually collect better data. But at no point, I'm always trying to avoid it, in spite of always being asked, well, what do you think should be done? What do you think about lockdown? Do you agree with it or not? I'm not going to say. And I've been trying to keep that line the whole way through. And I wonder if Florence would have been happy to stick to that line. If she was sitting there in her bedroom, as Deborah said, you know, being an absolute role model for lockdown, she'd have been there quite possibly doing online interviews with Newsnight. Would she have been happy just to explain about the evidence, or would she have been telling everybody what she thought should be done? And I suppose I'd just like to leave that as a slightly open question. As I said, maybe it's just my particular feeling that one thing I really like about the statistical profession is that they do not tend to be advocates for what should be done. They're advocates for better data and evidence and trying to understand how things are, you know, to see the world as it is. But they do not tend to be people who say, well, this is then what should be done. And I think that is a good role. So I'm just saying my opinion immediately. And I might find myself actually, I would hate to say it, disagreeing with Florence. I don't think I'd ever dare do that. But I do think that this is an important issue that she brings her model. Is it the right one? Is it one we should follow or not? So just to finish off, I'd like to say thank you so much, Deborah. Fantastic lecture. I really learned a lot. Great slides. And I love the tie-in with what's going on at the moment, all the work at Imperial and elsewhere, and the role of statisticians in all of that. Wonderful. And so it had a great arc to it. No, lovely, lovely structure. So with that, I'm going to stop rabbiting on and let Jen take control of whatever we're going to get asked next. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, David. You make a very good point. I've constantly been asked the same thing. They want you to give you an opinion on what should or shouldn't be happening, and very much just trying to err on, let's just talk about the evidence. We have had one question come in asking about whether or not you feel some of the statistical results have been hidden from the community. And, you know, I'm guessing it's maybe in response to COVID that what do we think the transparency has been like? Do you think we've been seeing all of the data that there has been available?
I mean, shall I start on that? I think there's been a real balance between doing what we normally do and putting things out slowly through peer review papers. So our first React data, we didn't get out there because we were doing it through normal channels. And actually the speed of this, you can't. And we see it with the vaccine studies that some data goes out there and then people say, but has that been peer reviewed? But they had, the companies have to tell their shareholders. With the study that I'm chairing the data monitoring committee for, we're still having debates about what the right channels of communication would be. And there's a real tension between immediacy, scrutiny, and you certainly want to keep things absolutely hidden. But if the others have got better solutions to that, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, do either of the Davids have any comment on that?
Oh yeah, I do. Yeah, can I barge, David, do you mind if I barge in first, open my big mouth first? This is incredibly important, and I so strongly believe, as we all do, in openness and transparency about evidence and data. But of course, and many people within we've got to distinguish, I think, between government and the organisations that are working within government is absolutely crucial. And I distinguish that very strongly, and that I spend my time criticising as loudly as possible what I feel are lapses on behalf of what are regarded as the political advisor, the number 10 comms group, etc., which essentially are representing what I feel are the politicians in the government. And at the same time, I do tend, I think quite reasonably, to defend very strongly the role of the organizations that are collecting the data and analyzing data, presenting it to the policymakers, and to a really quite an extraordinary extent, getting it out there to the public. You know, I'd like to point to, you know, I'm sorry, I'm conflict of interest. I'm now a non-executive director on the board of the UK Statistics Authority. So I would say that the ONS are doing a fantastic job at this, but the ONS are doing a fantastic job at it, I think, in getting the data out. There's vast amounts of new analyses, user requested data sets and so on. Public Health England, their dashboard was pretty crummy to start with, but they've had a fantastic team on that. And now it is extraordinary. And the masses of hits, I was on it, I'm on it, you know, 4:15 or so every day, I'm clicking on it and checking every day. You know, it's a really fantastic resource. And to provide an API so everyone could drag the data off there. So to go into other websites, the BBC one is very good, and all these other websites that people are constructing to analyze that data. Excellent transparency, and it's not just transparency in terms of what's appears to be called fishbowl transparency, just going blah and putting stuff out as massive PDFs that you can't get, you know, you can't do much with. This is transparency in a way that enables people, actually I think empowers people. Now Joint Biosecurity Center, which is, you know, keeps a really low profile. And I mean, I should say, because people may not realize, the director of that is Claire Gardner, who was my PhD student, who's a Bayesian statistician and worked at Imperial. So, which I think sets a very good standard. And actually the data that are used as the basis for the tiering decisions is out there. You know, it's being reported very, very quickly. Now it is that there is a 79-page PDF, but the data files are underneath. It's not easy to find particularly. You know, what's going on in every single area and all the stuff, the masses of it out there. And I've been saying, honestly, all these billions being spent on test and trace, vast amounts on, you know, management consultants, couldn't they have spent some more money on a decent website, given all the sacrifices we are all making continually, and we should be able to know exactly why these decisions are being made about us. So I would appeal, I think there have been great efforts made, but more could be done. But it is extraordinary what we have got access to, I think compared. I'm not talking about the use of graphs in briefings, and then we could get onto that later, but I have to control my language, of course. But in terms of the transparency of the data, there has been very good examples shown. And I think basically within the agencies, a huge amount of goodwill to do this.
David Cox, do you have any comments to add to that?
No, I feel sadly totally on the fringe of, or outside the fringe of this. I just look at the telly.
Probably not a bad thing for sanity.
I don't like what I see very often. I think it's often trying to put too much on one slide, put up a slide, take it away again. And it's an old trick that used to be very common in medical lectures, if I ever went to any 30 or 40 years ago. People would put up very complicated slides and take them away again before anyone had a chance to read them. I see far too much of that.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily criticize the work that's underneath.
Yeah.
But that's a separate issue. But the actual presentation to the public seems to me often astonishingly poor. Perhaps it's too hard.
David, I'm very, you're absolutely right, I think. And it's a great shame because there are very good analysts and people within government, within agencies. But then when it comes to this public presentation, it's some of the worst examples, I think, the sort of stuff that if it was done by a first year PhD student at a test lecture, we'd be there absolutely bellowing at them and saying this is unacceptable as part of a presentation. And then, you know, lots of coloured lines, which, you know, with a legend somewhere. So, some awful stuff. And, you know, there's one recently on the, which I've been ranting on about, on the main page, which is explaining the winter plans, terribly important. And it's some ghastly thing knocked up in Excel when you can't even tell whether the scale is linear or logarithmic. It's obviously, it's just used to make it look sciencey and to put some colour in. And, you know, rather than actually to inform anybody, and it's not done to any standards whatsoever, which, given there are so many good people who know in government agencies who know how to do good visualizations, I find it very upsetting.
Yeah. I think, by and large, stuff that comes from the ONS is much better.
Okay, so I'm aware there are a couple of people with hands up, but I'm going to try and do this I've been trying to keep an eye on the order in which things have come in. I think it's quite interesting as well, the Florence Nightingale lecture. We've had a couple of questions come in on this idea of sort of gender balance. One of which is saying their daughter attended a Maths Open Day and there were no women speakers. And when they asked why there were no women speakers, the comment was, how many famous women mathematicians can you name? I'm not going to ask you to go through them right now. But there's a question of, you know, do we always need to make sure that there's a woman on a panel? And we've also had a question in from Denise Leasley to David Cox. First of all, she says it's a fantastic book. Thank you very much, Deborah. But David, you're celebrated in the community for your research collaborations with large number of women. And Denise is interested as to whether or not this has been a deliberate decision on your part and how you feel it has contributed to your thinking.
Oh, not a deliberate decision. I've just had the great, great, great fortune to work with very able people of both genders. And incidentally, when I was at Imperial College, the appointment of statisticians certainly had nothing to do with gender at all. And we ended up with not far short of an equal mixture of men and women on merit, not because of any policy. So I collaborate with anybody who's got something. I feel I can just work with them and that we can together get productive results better than we could on our own. But conscious gender bias, no, I don't have one.
I think it's a really interesting point, this sort of positive discrimination and conscious gender bias, and should we always make sure there's a woman on a panel? Deborah, do you have any comments on that?
I do, because I think at the point at which people apply for a job, you want to appoint the best people. The thing beneath that is making sure that the level playing field so that women get a fair crack at doing the things that might get them to being appointed to a lecturer or a chair and so on. Where I would take a rather different line is when you're looking at particularly committees or public facing things, then absolutely you want balance and diversity. And whether that's RSS Council, for which we need, although we've just elected one batch, we need nominations by the end of this month for the next batch. About the last thing I do as outgoing president is to chair the president nominating committee for Sylvia's successor. We need diverse nominations for that, because if you haven't got diverse nominations, you're not drawing on the best. And so wherever you haven't got diverse nominations, you need to look and ask why. On a panel, we are sitting here, and in this day and age, it would be absolutely wrong if this was for men. And I don't think it'd be particularly helpful, except for things like a celebration of women in statistics, if it's all women. At the moment, there's a sort of rebalancing role for that. But you know, I'm very conscious that that is by no means the other diversity. We're sitting here for white people. So clearly there are some things need doing to change that. So Yeah, so that's where I'd have the symptoms. And certainly if you want to attract your best students to your university and you put an all-male panel and then you wonder why they go somewhere else, yeah, you'd have thought mathematicians would be able to think it through a little bit better than that, but there you go.
But I mean, it's one of the reasons I do, you know, feel very proud to be part of the statistical profession, in that, you know, in my experience, there isn't a need to make a big effort to get a gender balance on research teams or organisations. It just happens because there's just, there really is a, now, you know, there's a, they're, especially with the younger generation coming up, who are majority, I mean, females are in the majority, for, I think, for younger fellows. For the old, you know, the old males like me, it flips around, but that's going to be changing. So I really like the fact that that in a way, not a great effort is needed to get that balance in statistics at the moment, which is, I think it's something hugely to celebrate. It would be different in maths, I think, but it just shows, I think, what a wonderful subject we're in, that we don't have to make this effort. But as Deborah so rightly said, this is only in terms of gender balance. There's many other characteristics as well one would be concerned about.
Yeah, I actually did a little bit of an analysis looking at membership and the gender split. And, you know, you very much see that in the older generations, it's very male dominated. Yeah. But as you filter through, it is becoming more 50-50. And I do think that naturally, as time goes on, there will be more women taking president's roles and things like that. So, yeah, I'm quite encouraged by it. Mm. So we've got a couple of hands up. So I'm going to go to Lynn, first of all, who had her hand up for a little while now. So I believe Liam will unmute you so you can talk. Lynn?
Thank you. I'd like to respond to David Spiegelhalter's question about would she, and then present a problem and ask, you know, have any of you, you know, any means of doing anything about it or any answer to it? And the would she have given specific direct advice to policymakers like cabinet ministers? Yes, and she did. And her brief to the what's called Cubic Space Committee, which was part of the Poor Law Bill of 1867. She certainly gave very specific advice on that. And that can be seen as the first step towards getting to a national health service. Mm-hmm. That is, of establishing quality care for the poorest, not those who can pay for it. So that was very important. But the problem I want to raise, and we're getting away from the issues you've been talking about now, is going back to the Crimean War. We don't have, to my knowledge, correct me if you know of something, a really decent count of the war dead. The Nightingale's analysis and the Royal Commission analysis were both based on data from the Army Medical Department. Now, Nightingale often said how there were conflicting reports of dead. And of course, Alexander Tulloch collected data. It wasn't just the official people. And she did note in places that the number of people buried was greater than the number of people who died, you know, and wasn't suggesting anything went wrong, but clearly there were faults in the record keeping. But you see, her data for those wonderful polar area charts is based on what got to the Army Medical Department. And that's only people who got admitted to hospital, be it a regimental hospital or a general hospital. But men and officers who died on the battlefield, they're not counted there. Now, when I was in the UK last February and March and was planning to stay longer, I intended to go to the National Archives because they have the reports of the Adjutant General, which the British Library doesn't have, and that might help to fill in those gaps. But I have never seen a table which gives, you know, deaths in regimental hospitals, in general hospitals, blah, 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 and deaths on the battleground, and deaths of doctors and nurses and other people who were there doing other kinds of things. So we've never had a really full count on that subject. Anyone got any ideas or is willing to undertake to do it?
Sorry, can I barge in? Lynn, it's lovely to hear from you. I'm sorry, I haven't got any ideas. I don't know about these data sources, but I would like to draw a modern parallel because the crucial thing about this is that you can't interpret data unless you know the process by which it was collected. And a modern parallel is that, you know, the daily deaths reported on COVID are for people who have had a positive test and died within 28 days of any cause. And so people who caught it, in a sense, and dropped dead before they got tested won't be included in the daily counts. They won't be in the daily statistics. They'll be in the death registrations if they decide that they put it on the death certificate without being tested. So there's deaths that are not occurring. There again, people who got COVID and then got run over by a bus 3 weeks later will be included as a COVID death. And so, you know, it is rather important to always to know what is being counted. And I think this whole pandemic, although obviously there have been examples of wonderfully sophisticated modeling and computation, hugely elaborate analyses, so much of it has come down to the absolute basics with which Nightingale would have been so familiar, which is kind of tabulating data and understanding whether you can believe it or not.
And actually, what question you're trying to answer, because if you're trying to say, did COVID directly cause a death, that's different to monitoring deaths. So if you're clear what the question is, then you can be clear whether the data you've got is fit for purpose. I interrupted Sir David.
Yeah, David Cox, have you got any comments?
No, I don't.
No? Okay, so I think that there's a really interesting sort of, because we're only sort of about 5 minutes left or so now. So there's quite an interesting comment here on sort of practical statistics. Oh, we've also had a comment that's saying that Florence Nightingale would definitely be telling us to wash our hands.
Yeah.
So then there's a question talking about there's a tendency for statistical training to become increasingly mathematical to the exclusion of practical problem solving. What practical experience do the panel members consider essential for the next generation of statistical consultants, and how best we can communicate that to the public? And there's a sort of similar question saying how, you know, there's a lot of mathematical statistics where they may never have performed an experiment or survey in their life. And then we've got investigators on the other side who require statistical training, and what's happened to Nightingale's recommendation that practitioners do the education. I'm interested to hear your comments on that.
Well, could I make a comment?
Yeah.
That the general principle is you teach people things by developing out of what they already know or are interested in. So if you're interested, if you have students who've come to study at university to study mathematics and are deeply interested in pure mathematics and nothing much else, then you have to start with probability and gradually steer them towards the notion that hidden beyond all this mathematics are very, very interesting and important scientific problems which they may be able to do something useful about. Start with the mathematics and develop into the application. For most people, that would be an absolute disaster. You have to start with applications that are, to some extent at least, appreciated by the student in question, and develop out of that into some general ideas, out of the known and of interest into the unknown. And so it depends very much where your potential audience is starting. And if they're a mixture, you're in trouble, because you may have to try and appeal to various different categories of people before you develop the more detailed statistical ideas. And of course, it depends enormously also whether you've 8 lectures to explain the whole of statistics, or very, 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 very more than that. That makes a big difference as well.
Can I butt in there? Well, I've been working this area for nearly 50 years, and I finally actually learned the wisdom that David has just expressed. It's taken me a long time. I knew I should have listened to him a lot earlier. But But no, absolutely. I grew up in the mathematical route. You know, I enjoyed the pure maths until it got too difficult, and through the probability, and then mathematical statistics, and that's the route I took, and that's what I taught for years, and that's how I worked with the papers I wrote. And it's only recently, I think, that I've really flipped around and produced the book. Anyway, the point about this book, The Art of Statistics, is like my attempt at redemption, at completely flipping the whole thing around. And as David said, it depends where people are coming from. I was going to call it Stats for Data Scientists, because I wanted people who'd not come up through the mathematical route. And that's why probability doesn't come until 2/3 of the way through. So the and statistical inference, putting them together, is, you know, almost near the end of the book, because there's so much you can do through problem solving. You're absolutely problem driven all the time, question driven, problem driven. You can do such a vast amount. So it amazed me how much you could do without all this mathematical stuff. So I've had my Damascene moment, you know, a few years ago, and now have completely flipped around how I think statistics should be taught, except for the people, you know, who have come up through that mathematical route, and they have to be brought in a different way.
So I think implicit in what Sir David Cox was saying was that you kind of need both. You know, he was saying wherever they're starting, you need to sort of edge them in the other direction. And this may be the time to say that 40 years ago, I was doing a course in statistical inference. John Fry did it as a reading course. We had Cox and Hinckley as our course text. And what John Fry said to us, who was my lecturer, was, this is a book. You won't get everything out of the first time. You need to reread it next year and again in 5 years or so, because the more you have practical experience, the more you'll realise what he's trying to say. And equally, I would say those doing applied work from time to time need to be able to see the wood for the trees. So we wouldn't be able to deal with COVID if we hadn't had people dealing with other infectious diseases. Okay, the details are different, the modelling the same. So you've got to keep both in tension, which certainly, you know, both Sir Davids have done throughout their career. But I've still got that copy of Cox and Hinckley, and when I get back into my office, I shall be rescuing it and bringing it home.
Got mine too.
Okay, so we're pretty much at time, and I'm aware that I need to give Crystal a few moments to say her thanks to everybody and the final goodbyes. But are there any final comments from any of you that you'd like to make to round up the panel discussion?
I just want to say what a pleasure it's been.
Yes, and thank you again for the lecture. Fantastic.
And thank you to Oxford for putting this together, because it's been the most wonderful event. And although I'm very sorry that we're not going for tea and cake and walk around Oxford and a dinner for some of us, I think we've probably had a very different and in many ways much more enriching discussion than we might have done if we'd done it when it was originally planned. So thank you for reinventing it.
And one of the last things I will say is, one of the advantages of doing it online is that everybody writes their questions in the box, and we have got questions that we haven't been able to cover. I don't know if there are going to be any arrangements, but it may be possible. So I apologize for any of the questions we couldn't cover, but it may be possible to put those to our panelists after the event and perhaps write it up somewhere. But I will have to leave that to Oxford to see if it's possible. Sorry if I've given you a task there, Crystal. But there were some really interesting questions that we didn't get to cover, and I apologize for that. But thank you very much for a really interesting panel discussion. The three of you have been incredible, and I will hand over to Crystal for final goodbyes.
Okay, thanks to all of you for taking part and for spending this time being so extra special. Thanks to Deborah, because she did first the lecture and then the panel. But it's been really great to get your views on all of this, both looking back at what Florence did and what she might have done if she were alive now, as well as, you know, bringing in all these contemporary issues. Because I think, you know, I really genuinely think that mathematics and statistics specifically is just the ultimate transferable skill. You know, you can move or work on one thing and to another, and thereby meet such interesting people, as well as helping to answer interesting questions. It's been a tremendous pleasure for us to host it in a different way than we originally planned, but nonetheless, bring it to everybody in, and hopefully we were able to open this up to a wider audience than would have been able to to come had it been specifically in Oxford. So, you know, there are some silver linings in this. Deborah has said that very kindly she is willing to make her slides available. They are currently in a form that is too big to easily distribute, so we will have to do a little bit of IT compression on that before people end up hanging trying to download them. But we have your contact details, and so we will make those available. You saw the link already in the chat, so do visit the virtual exhibition if you haven't had a chance to already. There's lots of interesting stuff there. It's like you get to stand in a virtual room and choose what you focus on off the wall. It was a tremendous honor for Beverly Lane, who helped organize this, and I to go along and actually see and choose among the pieces of her original correspondence. And a huge thanks to Balliol for sharing those with us. To Beverly for having organized stage one and then stage two, and to everybody who's been involved to bring this to us. So thank you all very much. It seems like it's now the middle of the night, even though it's only 5 p.m. But really best wishes to everybody. Thank you for taking part, and we look forward to next year.
Thank you so much.
Bye, everyone. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you very much. Bye.